This is Iconic.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things Gumshoe. This is the third and final part of our look at the player side of the Gumshoe role-playing game, Swords of the Serpentine.
They do have a great selection of hazards, because these are things that come up in sword and sorcery games all the time. There are truly terrible diseases that slowly and progressively get worse, because that's when it's interesting. They don't ever want diseases to just be, hey, you show up, Mark, and your character's sick.
Uh-huh.
You know, sucks.
Yes, I got wet lung.
You got the wet lung. Throat leeches is my favorite.
That's what I was going to say.
Because at stage 5, a truly revolting number of throat leeches burst out of your neck, killing you. We're going to let you guys discover diseases on your own. But Becca, they have an interesting way of dealing with traps.
It's a trap. Yes. Yes, they do. There's two types of traps. There's the traps that say, stay out, go away, you don't want to come in here. And then there are traps that say, die, thief, die. And yeah, I liked that discussion of traps, because I think so often when we think of trap, the first one we think of is the traps that say die. But typically people put in a trap in order to keep people out, because having to clean up dead bodies every single time someone sneaks into your safe vault secret area is just a pain in the butt. So they have traps to stay out. So they often use maneuvers or non-deadly techniques. It will be obvious to the characters that there is a trap here. It will be clear, and the players will be able to use maneuvers and reactions in order to get around that trap. Traps that say die will not be obvious, will not be noticeable, will require your players to spend investigative points in order to see them, and then will intend to kill them. So you want to consider a few basics. What's the theme? What's the purpose? Who does the trap target? And does the trap have style? You know, you want to make traps that your players are going to remember.
It's not just a rocks fall, everyone dies. They want these to be thematic, and they want them to be exciting in a way that serves a purpose to the story.
The book gives you, the GM, and players ways to use both your social, the general investigative abilities, as well as your profession investigative abilities in figuring out what traps are and how to get around it, so that it's not just, yeah, too bad, so sad. It's okay, spend that point in tactics of death, and you can notice how the corpses lay on the floor here to know that the swinging blade comes from that direction and is probably invisible. So
yeah, I like the way they kind of laid out to, it's not always the invisible trap to, ha-ha, I killed your character. It's, they're obvious, you need to overcome them, and it's more of a delaying tactic or spend the resource kind of a thing. I like that.
Mm-hmm. And they give you just an example of the whirling blades of denial versus the whirling blades of death. The denial ones are going to keep kicking your characters back out. Whirling blades of death, it's in the name. So I like how they set up traps here. And I like how they allow players to take agency in overcoming the traps. And so it's not just the pit opens, you're dead, the rocks fall, you're dead. You never saw it coming, you're dead. Too bad, so sad. Moving on.
What I like about it too, it's not just, okay, the thief moves up and disarms the trap. It's, well, how do you do it? Well, because of my skullduggery, I know that this is how this trap is set up. And then you do your investigative spend to overcome the trap or figure out how to get around it or something like that. It's, I like that, a little more interaction with the players instead of saying, hey, you detect a trap. Okay, I break a roll, I disarm it, we move on.
All right, so Mark mentioned earlier that much like all the other Gumshoe games, investigative ability points only come back at the end of the adventure. However, They have introduced these things called refresh tokens that are designed to help you get your general abilities back much quicker. Mark, why don't you tell us about what refresh tokens are and how they get used at the table?
Yes. So, and James said, you can't do it for your investigative ones, but it's for your general abilities. And they do this, the whole idea of refreshes is because you're a big damn hero. We want you to keep doing things and not, well, I've spent all my sway. Nope, you can get refreshes. The example, the Whirling Blades of Denial. If you overcome that trap, you earn 5 refresh tokens by overcoming the trap.
Mm-hmm.
And they give some advice. You can use tokens, coins, little stones, put it in a bowl in the middle of the table, because we're all sitting around a table again gaming, and they're a group pool. So we overcome the trap, even though the thief was the one that did it, 5 tokens go in the bowl. And anyone can draw from the bowl. It's generally polite to ask, Jam, hey, I'm going to take 2 tokens to refresh my sway. Great, take 2 tokens out and you use them. And they encourage you to use them because once you're done, whatever's in the refresh goes away. They don't carry over. So as you do things and earn them, you can also earn them by defeating enemies, solving different things. I'm sure if you're the group's crack up that always has that appropriate joke at the right time, you're like, you know what? That's pretty funny. Put 3 tokens in the refresh bowl.
Like Becca.
Because you've done something for the group.
Yeah, Becca's always cracking us up.
And you can use these to each token refreshes 1 general pool ability, except health and morale. Can't do those for the player who uses it. And then the used token is discarded. And like I said, unused ones are done at the end of the scene. So as you're gathering things, if you need them, hey, let's pull them out. Let me refresh this going on the next thing. And there's a guide for defeating foes, solving non-combat challenges, GM discretion, and then there's even off-duty time. Hey, we're going to spend some time doing this. You can get some tokens for that. And at the end of the adventure, like other Gumshoe, all your general abilities refresh. So you can start fresh at the end of the adventure. But it's nice as you're going through things, kind of like, remember we talked about Knights Black Agents, if you had a cherry, you could describe some things and get a refresh on that ability to kind of help you keep moving forward.
Yeah.
Here, we all generate it, put it in a bowl, and you can use them as you're going to keep the battle going, to allow you to do the extra damage, swing that sword or spray that necrotic attack from your sorcerer.
Well, that's a good, and we're going to talk about sorcery next. I know we've been talking about it. Sorcery is great because it essentially, as we said, is a very flexible attack skill that allows you to replicate effects on the fly. And what's interesting is you have to choose whether you want it to do health or morale. And more importantly, the way it works is you get 1 sphere of influence per point of corruption that you have. So the more corruption you have, the more different ways you could affect the world with sorcery. And the thing is that sorcery spheres are really more flavors and themes than they are like mechanical bits. It still all works the same way. However, they tell you kind of what special effects you can have using your sorcery. So the more corruption you have, the more spheres you have, and also if you want to do something besides just damage something, you have to spend corruption to get these additional effects within your spheres. And that's essentially the way sorcery works. It is very broad, and I really enjoy the flexibility one would have at playing a sorcerer. Without spending any points, you can use sorcery to describe any unopposed regular activity that anyone could do. So you could make yourself, you could open and close the unlocked door with sorcery. You could light a torch. You could use it as an investigative, use any investigative ability, but describe it's coming from your sorcery. So the examples they give are charismatic people can use charm to charm people. You can do it as long as one of your sorcerous spheres would apply to it. You can make general tests out of your sorcery pool. You can use sorcery as a combat ability or to create maneuvers. Some of these require corruption to trigger their effects. So you can do better damage, area damage, craft unique spells, curse enemies, or create your own traps. So if you want to play a sorcerer, you get, it reminds me a little bit of Mage. You get a lot of freedom as long as you work within the bounds of your spheres and pay the appropriate costs. And I love that they say, hey, GMs, this is a lot of stuff. It's probably, it is the most general or flexible general ability. And that's fine. It's designed that way. I think that's one of the reasons that each of the professions gets some really cool, unique investigative abilities, because sorcery for sorcerers also kind of gives them a very cool, very flexible ability based off of just the creativity of the player. What did you guys think of sorcery as you were reading through it?
I liked it. And I would definitely say, as a GM, work with the player that wants to be a sorcerer, who's used to more traditional D20 style. Here's a list of spells. Mm-hmm. This is what I can do. They have so much flexibility. They really have to design what they want it to do.
Yeah.
It's really neat. What you didn't mention is when you spend that point of corruption, you have to either internalize it or externalize it.
I was getting to that, but why don't you explain it, Mark?
Well, either you make a health test against a corruption, or you spread it out amongst your allies and they make morale tests, because you just erupted with horrible things and just decimated your enemies. And so you can internalize the corruption and save against it, or your allies can go and make a save against their morale to go, we don't want to hang out with Jam anymore.
Well, there's also the fact that if you externalize it, it damages the fabric of the city as well. And we'll get into that when we talk about the goddess and we talk about Eversync itself. It definitely feels like that, as Mark said, the DCC effect, where the more you use magic, the more you are going to mutate or corrupt yourself. It reminded me a lot of the Dark Sun, the Preservers, and the Defilers. But instead of putting energy out into the world like corruption, you were drawing energy in that game either from yourself or from the world around you.
Not saying it, if you play it, you're going to be corrupted and die. If you want to be a powerful sorcerer,
you're going to be corrupted and die.
If you do minor things and you want to dabble, you can probably be okay. It's if you really want to lay waste to, you know, the five cultists coming from Becca's death cult with poison daggers, and your sorcerer goes, I got this, and goes and decimates them, the rest of the group might go, that wasn't very good. Not that there's really much difference between stabby, stabby death or
no, it's all brain death. Death is death.
But it just looks weird. I think you said the neighborhood and all that. So, yeah, that's.
Well, let's round out our look at the player section of this. So, Becca, why don't you tell us about how wealth works? Are we going to be counting coins in this game or?
Yes. Yeah. Count up all of your coins, because 3 pip bits equals 1 iron tri-penny. 3 tri-pennies equals 1 iron penny. 13 pen. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
I mean, that list is in the book.
It is.
The designers of this game intentionally created coins to be difficult and complicated. That's not how you are going to be using your money and wealth in Eversync. Instead of trying to figure out how many bridges you need in order to get some silver signets to pay, we're not going to deal with that. You have wealth. Typically 1 through 5. Wealth 1 is enough to live a life of squalor between adventures. Wealth 5 is going to be an opulent lifestyle between adventures. Being able to spend 1 wealth 5 times is very different than spending a wealth of 5. Mm-hmm. They liken it to the fact that in any movies where there's a heist or there's a sudden collection of goods, chests of gold, the Cave of Wonders, the heroes don't sit there and count out how many coins they've all gotten. They go, sweet, we're rich, and they move on with their lives. Similarly, that's how you are going to be looking at wealth here. If you want to be able to spend a night in a very nice inn, or if you want to have a wealthy or well-to-do house, that's going to require different amounts of wealth. You're not going to have to worry about counting out money, but you are going to be considering how much wealth do I have? And that is both the coins in your pocket, the things back at your home, what you have buried out by that one tree, and what is, you know, hidden in the bank. And you can change your wealth into lifestyle points. You can also use wealth when you are then trying to get something from other people in bribery and preparedness. They did just say, like, just so you know, like, if you do find the legendary ruby the size of a baby's fist, it's going to be worth 75 wealth, but you can't use that until you have fenced that ruby and gotten that wealth. So it changes how players can look at wealth and how you use it. And you're not sitting there creating long lists of every single gem, coin, and jewelry that you have ever gotten. I like it. I think it makes it simple. But I know plenty of people who do enjoy counting out their coins in between adventures. So
their silver shekels.
That we do.
So Becca mentioned lifestyle. Mark, do you want to give a brief overview of lifestyle?
Yes. So the wealth and lifestyle are really tied very well together. You know, we've completed burning down the cult of death that Becca created, and the GM rewards us with 7 wealth each. Okay, so that's a lot. How do I want to spend that? And the lifestyles are tied into levels of lifestyle. You have low repute, no repute, and high repute. You'll all start the first adventure with no repute. You're right in the middle. There's no plus or minus for any thing you want to do in society. You spend your wealth, and you have to spend at least one, as Becca alluded to, one wealth is a squalid lifestyle, and your low repute would be 2. And you think, well, I just got all this wealth from the GM. Why would I do that? Well, if you're the thief and you like dealing with people on the lower end of society, you'd probably want to be squalid or struggling, which is the next level, to deal with them. Because if you go and rent the villa and spend 5 wealth and throw parties and you walk down there with your silks and satins and try to talk to the beggar to find out the information on the new death cult, since you crushed the old one, they're not going to deal with you because you're the wretch snob from uphill, not down here in the dirty canal where I live. So you want to blend in. The same thing if you say, well, I spent 5 and I only have 2 for the next adventure, because that's wealth setting is for your next adventure. That's the level you're living at. Say we don't really gain much. I've got 2 wealth for the next one. Now I'm struggling. And our next job means we have to infiltrate the ball that the Countess is throwing. I'm not going to fit in because I don't have the right clothes or the right pole. I didn't throw the soiree last week and get invited to her ball. You want someone to have that 4 or 5, the wealthier opulent level and high repute to be invited. Oh, yes, I'm going to invite Becca. Remember that party she threw last week? It was a great, let's invite her and her friends to this one. And then you can move along with your adventure. So it does depend on what you're doing, where you want to be on that social structure. It's very, very stratified, that 1 to 5, 1 being the poorest, 5 being the wealthiest, and how you spend it. And the way I see it, if we get awarded 7, okay, I'm going to stay comfortable right in the middle and not have any kind of plus or minuses, and I'll just bank the rest. Because it's not just chests of gold or the ruby the size of a baby's fist. It might be a merchant contracts where I've helped mercantile family, and so I have wealth from that to spend. So you can keep it. It just really depends. And I would say within the group, you can say, all right, James is a sorcerer, so he's going to be comfortable. I'll play the thief. I'm going to live squalid. And Becca is the sentinel, so she's going to be wealthy and deal with those circles. And so the group is kind of spread out and can deal with different things in society. That's how I see it going. If we all are wealthy, then we're going to have a tough time going down to the streets. They'll probably want to roll us for our coin and take our tribits and half swans. I love that list of coinage, which just is in so many different fantasy books of how much is that really?
Right. No, I love it. And I mean, there's also 30 pages of interesting gear from the mundane to firearms to alchemical things to sorcerous items, all which are available for players to buy and purchase with their wealth. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. And when we come back next time, we're going to be looking at the GM side of the book. We covered about half of the book. When we're looking at the GM side of the book, we're also going to be trying to get an interview with Kevin here before we get to our actual play, rounding out this latest season of the Iconic Podcast. Next season, we're going to switch the format again. Instead of covering Gumshoe or 13th Age in the normal way we have done it for the first six seasons, we're going to be running an actual play of the 13th Age 2nd Edition playtest with Rob Heinsu of Pelgrane Press and 13th Age fame. He will be joining us and we will be playing. You'll be able to catch it live on Twitch, and then it will be pulled down and turned into a actual play podcast. We're going to use the 13th Age soundtrack. We're going to try and edit it to be pretty tight. All of that's coming up in season 7, but we're going to finish our look at Swords of the Serpentine and get an interview with Kevin Culp in before we do our actual play. So as always, Beck and Mark, thank you so much for joining with me on this journey through a whirlwind tour, if you will, of Gumshoe. We will be back in 2 weeks with even more Iconic Podcast. Until then, have a good one.
And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/iconicpodcast.
You've been listening to the Iconic Podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com. Also, check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and more information about the show. Thanks for listening.